When you open the bottle and you drink the wine, it speaks for itself. Is it, you know, a wine that's made for food? Yes. Those types of wines are tend to be more rustic or have a little bit more body. Are there wines that are just pure out hedonistic pleasure? Sure, there's wines like that that maybe from California that are more cocktail wines, or wines that are just big jammy fruit bombs. And those, I think, appeal to a certain group of people as well. I think the wines that Barterhouse specializes in is more of these food-friendly, you know, rustic style, biodynamic, organic wines that tend to be a bit more earthy, come from someplace. So you can almost taste the terroir. You can almost feel this guy, this Sancerre, was grown in this slaty, rocky soil. And so to me, that's the exciting part, that the wine feels like it comes from someplace.
Hi, good morning, everybody, with this music, great background that Jack has put on. This is Bernie Wides, the naturalist. My co-host, Carol Butler, is not with me today. She's working on her next book. You know, Carol is terrific at books, and this one is going to be on bedbugs, which is a really current topic. So I have two guests today that were on once before, and we're going to do two shows. We'll do one show with a short segment on solar energy. Because let me introduce my guests today, Pierre and Ariana Ricard. Say hi, folks.
Hi, thanks for having us on again.
Hello, Bernie.
Okay, so Pierre is working for his organization. He'll tell you all about it. We'll do a little short spot for solar energy, and then we're going to Florida after that, because these folks had a great time in Florida, and we're going to hear about their experiences and talk about the critters that live there and history of Everglades and all that. So, P.S., start off and tell us about what's happening in Albany in the legislature.
Sure. Well, as you might recall from last fall, I had come on and given you a quick sort of overview of what we had gone through last year as far as pushing some legislation on solar through the New York State Legislature. We came really close last year. This year, we feel like we have a much better chance. We've got a sort of sky-high rating for a governor, and also the budget is finished. So all those sort of elements make it a very positive environment, moving the solar bill forward again this year. By virtue of having it go through last year and getting some attention of certain folks, I think this mm-hmm. year we'll have an even larger presence in Albany.
Okay, give us a quick review of the bill. What basically it says, what are you trying to do, and that kind of stuff. Okay,
sure.
You have like 4 minutes, Pierre.
Yep. So the bill is intended to, of course, increase investment in solar, primarily solar photovoltaic in New York State. And the goal would set out from the year 2013 through the year 2025 an obligation on the power companies in New York State, the utilities, as well as the what they're known as retail electric suppliers. And they're the ones who bill you for energy every month.
Mm, like Con Edison and mm-hmm. all mm-hmm. those
yep.
monsters. Oh, sorry.
And so they would have the obligation to purchase an increasing percentage of solar every year. And the idea is to kind of provide a smooth glide path to build the solar industry in New York State. And it allows for a tradable credit mechanism.
Ah, that's good.
So it is sort of a market-based to try to be as competitive as possible for mm-hmm. companies to compete with one another and bring the cost down more rapidly.
Okay, so this is on industrial level. What about for the folks who have a house with a great roof for solar?
Sure.
Are we still going to get a tax credit, or how's that going to work? Is that in the same bill, or what?
Yeah, actually, the bill itself carves out a 20% piece currently for system sizes that would be relevant for small homeowners and small commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And the tax credit, which is currently coming from the federal government, is still set to last through the year 2016.
Mm.
And
okay, good.
Yeah, hopefully we can, I guess the hope is in sort of American energy politics that you know, we can continue to build the solar industry along with wind and other renewables and really have a political presence in Washington.
Terrific. And maybe cut down on our imported oil.
Yeah. Yeah.
Last question. What's the estimate if we use solar in the United States? What percentage are we targeting? 15% of our energy or 20%? Or what do you folks figure?
Yeah, the bill itself would get us to about 3% by 2025, but hopefully, you know, at some point solar might actually be less expensive than sort of what's being supplied right now by fossil fuels. In fact, we see a trajectory where that will happen.
Yeah, oil prices keep going up and solar will come down.
Yeah, and so I think nationally it certainly is reasonable to see maybe a 15 to 20%, say maybe by 2030 is kind of the sort of trend. Yeah.
Good. Let's hope this trend is upward.
Yeah.
And that's what we played. Here comes the sun this morning, even though this morning out here in Bushwick it's a little cloudy. But I think it's clearing up, so that's a good sign.
Indeed.
Okay, so that was Pierre Ricard, who was working for the
Natural Resources Defense Council.
Yeah, and they're lobbying for more use of solar resources.
Right.
Especially in New York State, because it's the chapter in New York State that's doing this, right? Well, the national, too.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, terrific. So why don't you guys tell me about your trip to Florida, which sounded like a great trip. And then we'll talk about specifically where you went and the Everglades and all that great stuff.
All right. So we went to the Everglades last month. We started off, we more covered the eastern part of the Everglades. So we biked in Shark Valley. We hiked the Anhinga Trail. We canoed in Nine Mile Pond. And the Everglades is incredible. To me, it's like the Galapagos of America. Just so much diversity of wildlife and so accessible. And the wildlife seem to be used to people and you can get really close to them, especially on the Anhinga Trail.
Hmm.
I think what I read is that there isn't that much water in that area, so all the wildlife have to concentrate in that one spot. So if you walk this boardwalk trail, the wildlife are roosting right above your head, right along the boardwalk. The gators are right underneath, super close. Mm-hmm. So it was really, really cool.
It was a good trip.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. we'll just talk a minute about the history of the Everglades Park and all that. And what was there before the park? It was a wilderness. It still is. Luckily, the park has preserved it. I think Everglades has 1 million acres.
I think what I read, it has 1.5 million acres. Okay. It's the third largest park in the contiguous U.S. behind Yellowstone and Death Valley.
Right, and it was the biggest area in the United States without any roads in it, I think, at one time.
Oh, okay.
The only road in it was the road from the visitor center down to Flamingo, and that's it.
Mm.
And the rest of it was just a roadless wilderness or wildlands or whatever you want to call it. And the reason that the park is there are a lot of reasons, but if we go back in the history, before it was a park, it was a wide open area for hunting and fishing and trapping. And in the 1890s, I think you wrote about this, Ariana, there was a big thing about hunting for plumes, bird feathers. Women's hats in the 1890s had a lot of feathers on them, and some of them even had whole birds on the hats.
Oh, wow.
It was, I looked this up, and it was really funny to see this woman, fancy dressed woman, walking down the street with a whole bird, like sitting on a nest with the beautiful feathers. Wow. So that became such a craze that there were all these plume hunters or bounty hunters who were down there, and the best time to kill the birds to get the plumes was when they were nesting, because they have this beautiful plumage during the nesting season. You know, all animals do that. During the mating season, they put on their best show, the best feathers and best fur and behavior and all that. We do the same thing to attract the mate. So that's when they have these beautiful, especially the egrets. It's called an egret feathers, the long white feathers in the breeding season. And that's what they wanted for the hats.
Mm.
So they went down and hunted and killed them by the millions. So
I think one thing I read when John James Audubon went down to visit before these populations were decimated by the plume hunters, he would see flocks of birds, so many birds that they would cover, you couldn't even see the sun. There were just so many
millions
birds there.
Millions and millions of birds.
Yeah, and I read before humans came down and, before they started hunting, there was 100,000 pairs of wading birds, and now maybe 10,000, so it's a reduction of 90%.
Right.
And the populations have rebounded somewhat, but still not to those levels from before.
Yeah. So just another quick word about how the park started. So if we go back to Civil War time, the 1800s, during the Civil War, Florida was still a territory of Spain. And then we made some deal with Spain, and we got it. And it was a territory of the United States. It wasn't a state. So a lot of things happened around the Civil War. First of all, soldiers who deserted both sides headed down into the glades or jungle, as they call it. Indians who were being rounded up in North Carolina, South Carolina, the Cherokee, and a lot of other tribes were being rounded up. A lot of them fled into the glades. The local population of Native Americans were there, and they were called. They were a couple of tribes. The Tinicum and I forgot the name of the other tribe. I'd have to look at it. The Tinicum and the Tequestas were living there. And before that, there was a tribe called the Colusas. And the Colusas were nice and big and strong, just like you look. I don't know how strong you are, but you're nice and big.
Strong.
Strong. And they were really very powerful. And they fought off all attempts to take over their territories. Mm. But they disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to them. The legend is that they went to Cuba because they couldn't take the harassment anymore. So here was this great big wilderness area that was open for hunting and fishing and trapping and poaching and all that stuff, and they were wiping out the plume birds. So some of the bird clubs in Florida and the early Audubon Society started to see what was happening, and they hired the first game warden in the United States. Did you read about him, Guy Bradley?
Yeah, Guy Bradley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you see his... his statue, there's a memorial to him, I think.
Maybe at the Ernest Cove Visitor
Center? Yeah, I don't remember where it is. But anyhow, he was hired to keep an eye on this area, which was huge. I mean, the park is about 1.5 million acres now, so you know how much territory there is. And all around the park, there was nothing there either. It was all wilderness. So they hired one guy to patrol this whole area, and he was stationed in Flamingo, where you guys went.
Oh, okay.
And what happened was some poachers killed him. And it's sad that they killed him, but this got a lot of publicity. Congress passed the Migratory Bird Act. New York State passed the Audubon Plumage Act. And the whole millinery industry was in New York City. So they passed a law that you couldn't import from out of New York State any bird feathers or plumes. So that sort of killed the millinerers putting all these feathers on hats.
Mm.
So that's the beginning of the park. And then over the years, there was legislation to form the park. I think in 1947, it actually became a park.
Yeah, dedicated by President Truman.
Yep. He flew into Everglades City because that was the only airstrip in the area. Very small dirt airstrip. He flew in on a DC-3, which was a two-engine plane, because nothing else could land there. That area. And he made the declaration that it's going to be a national park for all the people, blah, 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 blah. And then the National Park Service took over, and it became a park. Okay, so tell us there's some animals you specifically want to talk to from your trip?
Yeah, the Everglades now is home to at least 25 species of orchids, 100 species of trees, and approximately 300 species of birds. So if you're a birder, this is the place to go. Because you can see some of the subtropical species, the tropical species, the migrant species that are using the park.
So I know you put the map up on the website, folks. So if you want to see what we're talking about after the show, go to our site and you'll see the pictures that Ariana put up. The map of the park, and you circled Shark Valley and the other. So tell the folks about Shark Valley. What is it? Did you see any sharks in Shark Valley?
No. And we actually couldn't figure out why it's called Shark Valley.
I'll tell you why.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So you want to talk about that, Pierre?
Well, I guess getting started, it was the first day I've been to the park. I was there for the second half of our trip, and we had seen that there's a bike trail that is 18 miles.
I think 15 or 17. I found 15. Two different numbers.
Anyway, it's a good distance, but definitely a beautiful part of the park. It's really in the northern part of it, more inland, and provides excellent habitat for many of the alligator species, and yeah. We saw them all over along the trail and the sort of canal way that was dug out beside the trail.
And the other nice thing about Shark Valley is if you don't want to bike or if you don't want to walk, you can take a tram, and the tram does that same loop. And that's the other thing that really impressed me about the Everglades is how accessible it is for people who have any mobility difficulties. There's all these wheelchair accessible areas. You can, in Eco Pond, one of the great birding spots, you can roll the wheelchair right up to the best spot, and you can see all these roseate spoonbills and snowy egrets and wood storks. And also, in the Everglades, there are all these park rangers, just like Bernie, offering wonderful programs for free. Like every day, there was like 5 or 6 programs that you could do. You could canoe with the rangers for free if you just signed up ahead of time. So Shark Valley, I mean, we had to pay to rent the bikes, but it really wasn't that expensive. And then on the tram tour, like, you could see that the gators are just sitting right on the pathway, sunning themselves. Right. You could get so close to them, and they
you
didn't
have to go
seem
around
to mind.
Them. They don't move.
Yeah, that's they right. don't. They didn't seem to
it's
mind.
It's their
at
park,
all.
You know. They're the original residents, so they're not going to move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then at the midpoint of the Shark Valley Trail is a observation tower, maybe like a 50-foot high observation tower, so you can see the river of grass all along there. And the other nice thing about Shark Valley is the water is flowing there, so there isn't such a problem with mosquitoes, so you didn't need any bug repellent there. Where the other part, near Flamingo, you needed bug repellent, a lot of bug repellent.
Yes, you met the famous resident mosquitoes.
Yes, the salt marsh mosquito.
Yeah, so Shark Valley, folks, is not really a valley. In South Florida, there's a just if you drive along the road, there's a place called Cutler Ridge. I don't know if you remember it. Mm-hmm. Or there's a place called the Pass. And the Pass is 5 feet above sea level. So you know that the elevation in that part of Florida, it's almost perfectly flat.
Hmm.
The only high points are the hammocks, which where a lot of trees go. It's a raised area in the sawgrass. So the Indians called it Paheoke, which means a river of grass. And there's a book written by, I think, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, who was a pioneer. Did she write that book, River of Grass?
The Everglades, River of Grass.
Yeah. It's a very nice book about the early glades when they were trying to form the park.
And that book did motivate public support.
Yeah, she was a big advocate.
Protected.
She lived in Miami, and in those days, Miami was a little village.
Hmm.
And that's it. None of the glitz, no high-rise, no nothing. It was just a coastal community.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it was there is because of the railroad. Did you read about Flagler's Railroad?
No.
Oh, okay. I will talk about that a little
later. I think that he wanted to put the railroad there.
Yeah, he wanted to put it inland in the park. But he didn't. He built it along the coast.
Mm.
And when he first built it, you could go from New York City to, I think, St. Augustine. I don't think the railroad went any further south than that. So St. Augustine became a built-up area. You know, it was Spanish years ago, so everything is Saint this and Saint that, and a lot of Spanish architecture. It's actually a nice place to still visit. And so people, mostly rich people, used to come down from the north to get away from the winter. And that's the starting of the trend of the snowbirds, as people are called, who go south for the winter. And the railroad went as far as a little north first, and then to St. Augustine, and it stopped there. So that area became built up. And then he decided to build it further down, and he was going to put it inland, the Everglades, but he decided he ran it along the coast. So it went all along the coast, and went all the way to Key West. If you take that, you took that highway, right?
Well, we only went to Key Largo. We didn't go further than.
But that I don't know if you saw, alongside that highway is still the old railroad trestle.
Oh, wow.
And that they preserved it, and people fish on it, or, you know, it's just a historical thing. So he built it all the way down. It was a great engineering job to build it over the open water there. So that's what helped build up Florida. But luckily, he didn't put it in where the park was going to be.
Well, that's good.
That was good.
Definitely.
So
why is it called Shark Valley?
Shark Valley, because the water drainage in Florida is it drains from northeast to southwest. Okay, so when it rains up in Kissimmee and, you know, where Disney World and Disneyland, all those places are, all that water runs south and west. And when Florida was being built up, they formed this Florida Water Commission, because their idea was to divert the waters. Instead of flowing in their natural course down towards the Everglades, they would divert the waters out to the ocean so the land would dry out and they could build houses and industry in it. That's why you have all those houses and everything in most of Florida already, because they drained the swamps.
Mm-hmm.
That was the big cry years ago. Drain those damn swamps. Get rid of those mosquitoes. So what happened was that they changed the water drainage patterns by putting in canals all over the place and diverting the water that would normally go to the Everglades out into the ocean. So the Everglades became starved for water.
Mm.
So Shark Valley is maybe, if it's a valley, maybe it's a 1 foot difference in elevation.
Oh.
But it does drain out to the Shark River, which goes into the Gulf of Mexico on the western side of Florida.
Oh, okay.
And there are sharks that river there. But they never come up into the park because the water's too shallow and they don't like fresh water.
Mm.
Yeah. So that's where Shark Valley came from. So that was your first stop in the park.
Well, actually, I had gone before Pierre, and I had met up with my friend from the Peace Corps, Trent Blair, and he brought some of his friends. He's a PhD student at the University of Florida in Gainesville. So he brought three of his friends down with us, and then Pierre came later on in the week. So we first started in Flamingo.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. And our first hike was a bird watching trip with one of the rangers, starting at the visitor center at Flamingo.
Mm, good. Okay, so we're going to have to stop now. The first show is almost over. But do you know, are they rebuilding the visitor center in Flamingo? I think it was destroyed by the last hurricane.
Yeah, I think that's rebuilt. The Flamingo Lodge was destroyed, so there is now some discussion about what they're going to put in to replace that lodge. They want it to be more green and environmentally sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are plans, and it's in the public comment period for that.
Okay. So it would probably be a good idea to rebuild that lodge, because mm-hmm. it's such a great spot. And not everybody wants a tent and camp. And
but still, it's a great deal to camp there at Flamingo. There's hot water from solar panels, which Pierre is happy about that. Because before it was just cold showers. And it's only $16 to camp there per night.
That's
so it's
great.
A great deal.
Yeah.
And only $10 for a weekly pass to the park.
Oh, that's not bad either.
Yeah.
But you know, if you're a big user of the national parks, you can buy a Golden Eagle Pass.
Mm.
You pay a fee like $50, and you get this card. Everything is free.
Yeah, my mom, Susan Rickard, she wants to get one of those passes.
Yeah.
She was just telling me about it last weekend.
Sure, she's a senior, right?
Yeah, well, or almost.
Almost. Well, if you're a senior, I mean, it used to be free for seniors.
Or maybe she is, I don't know.
Yeah. When I got mine, it was free, but now I think it's like $10 for seniors or something.
Yeah, it's a great deal.
It's a great bargain, because if you go in a car and you have the Golden Eagle Pass, everybody in the car gets in for free with you. So unless they've changed it now, because of course they need money, but I don't know. So Flamingo is an interesting spot. Jack, how much time we have left? Okay, I think we're almost out of time for the first show.
Just the first break.
Okay, the first break. Okay, so we're going to take a break now, and then we'll be back in a minute, and we'll talk about your adventures in Flamingo.
Great.
Following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to Greenhorn Radio, hosted by Severin von Scharner Fleming, every Thursday at 2 p.m. Greenhorn Radio is radio for young farmers by young farmers. Helmed by acclaimed activist, farmer, and documentarian Severin Fleming, Greenhorn Radio is a weekly phone interview session surveying America's cutting edge under 40 farmers. Again, that's every Thursday at 2 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air with The Naturalist Show. As I said before, my co-host Carol Butler is off today. She's working hard on a bed bug book. I mean, she did one on butterflies. That was a couple of years ago. And my guests today are Ariana Ricard and her husband, Pierre. And they were talking about their trip to the Everglades. So we're going to go back to the Everglades. Let's see. What month is this? This is April. Okay. I wouldn't advise going to the Everglades in April. Anytime after March, the mosquitoes rule. But tell us about your adventures. Let's tell people where Flamingo is first in the park.
So Flamingo is at the end of the main park road. So maybe like an hour drive from
the eastern
entrance.
Yeah, it's about 60 miles, I think.
Mm-hmm. And it's right on the Florida Bay. So if you camp, you wake up and you're right there at the water. You can see the beautiful sunrise and sunset right there. It's a great spot. And right there is a lot of trails, and you're near the Flamingo Visitor Center. So you can go on ranger-led programs, and you can get to the canoeing trips too from there. And it's near a marina where sometimes you can see manatees and crocodiles.
Did you see any of the manatees there?
I didn't see any manatees, okay. Unfortunately.
They're very hard to see because they just pop up for a second to breathe and then they're down again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, through evolution, their noses, like ours in the front of our face, the noses have migrated to almost the top of their head. So they don't have to stick their whole head out to take a breath. So that's it.
But if you want to see manatees, yeah. I think a good place to go is Crystal River.
Right, that's
the National Wildlife Refuge is on the western side. So I went there with my same friend, Trent Blair, and his friend Shirley, and my sister, Sasha Rickard, and you can swim with the manatees there. People have been swimming with the manatees forever.
Yeah, we did that. Yeah.
Yeah, and you're not supposed to touch them, but the manatees like having ladies with long fingernails scratch the algae off of their back.
Right.
So they will come right up to you and ask you to scratch them and rub their bellies. And my sister got to rub one of their bellies, even though you're not supposed to.
Yeah, they're really sweet animals, very calm and all mm-hmm. that. So let's go back to your adventures, and if we have time, we'll talk more about manatees.
Okay. So I was going to talk about the crocodiles. We just heard Crocodile Rock. So the American crocodile, you can see it in this part of the Everglades. They, unlike the American alligator, they prefer salt water or brackish water. So right there at the marina, you can see the crocodiles setting themselves at Buttonwood Canal. So right behind the marina store, I saw my first American crocodile. And they're distinguishable from the American alligators. The American alligators, the skin is more black, and the crocodile is gray, and the snout's a little different. The gator has more of a rounded snout, and the crocodile has a narrow snout. And also you can see some teeth from the lower jaw on the crocodile when the mouth is closed. So that's how you can tell the difference between them. And the American crocodile, like I said, is endangered, and the estimates are that there are about 1,000 in Florida. And the crocodiles are a little bit bigger than the alligators. But, and what else about them? So the other interesting thing about the crocodiles and the alligators is that these reptiles actually care for their young. The gators more than the crocodiles. So the crocodiles and the alligators, they both build nests during the nesting season made of loose dirt and vegetation. And then this vegetation will rot and keep the eggs warm in the sun. And then when the baby gators or the baby crocs start emerging from the eggs, the mom will actually dig them out and carry them in her mouth to the nearest water. But for the American crocodile, she will abandon the babies then, and then the babies just sort of stick together for a month for mutual protection. But the gator mom will protect her babies for up to 2 years, which is really unheard of in a reptile species.
In reptiles, mm-hmm. right. Terrific.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to see the crocs.
Yeah, and then I also read another interesting story about the crocodile. So their numbers are declining, but they have found a home near a Florida Power and Light Company, their Turkey Point nuclear power plant. So just like the manatees who are near, I think, another nuclear power plant on the eastern side of Florida, these crocodiles have made their home in the warm waters near the cooling towers of this power plant, and they've been living there for more than 30 years. Because the crocodiles have been chased away from the sandy beaches of Florida, so now they've moved up into this area, and the warm water discharged from the plant is not radioactive or harmful, and so it's a great home for the crocodiles. And about every year, biologists tag 100 newborn crocodiles, but only 10% of them reach maturity.
Yeah, sure. So there's another interesting thing about, I think, both crocodiles and alligators, about the sex of the offspring. Did mm-hmm. you read about that?
The environmental determination.
Yes.
So the temperature of the sand.
Right.
Determine whether they're female or male. Which is a concern for global warming. If you're going to have hatchlings that are all the same sex.
Mm-hmm. So that's common for a lot of, I think, reptiles, especially the crocodilians. When they lay their eggs, the sex is not determined. They have a capacity to go either way, mm-hmm. either sex. And it's the temperature of the sand that actually determines what the sex is going to be. It's the same with the turtles, the sea turtles, mm-hmm. you know, the logheads and the ridleys and all those. Because they did a study once in Florida where they're continually pumping sand up onto to re-nourish the beaches. Mm-hmm. So if they use the local sand that from the bottom where they pump up the sand onto the beaches, it's a certain kind of sand. They're running out of that sand. So they have to bring in sand from almost out to the Bahamas. It's a different kind of sand. So it has changed the sex ratios of the turtles because it's a different kind of sand, makes a different temperature in the sand. So there's an interesting thing. If you meddle around mm-hmm. with what's going on, you never know the consequences. And this nobody realized that mm-hmm. until that. Because the sand in Florida is limestone sand, you know, from the reefs and from the parrotfish. Remember my show on Belize? Mm-hmm. I spoke about the parrotfish. They mm-hmm. bite off pieces of coral. They take the living stuff and the protein out of it, and they poop out the coral in the form of sand. That's what builds up the beaches. And Florida's a big, big reef. The whole peninsula of Florida is a huge, huge, huge reef that was fossilized and all that. So there's another example with mm-hmm. the sea turtles. Okay, so continue. Tell us now about whatever's next.
Okay, so so I was saying that we did a bird watching trip with one of the park rangers, Shauna, I think, that first morning. And right at the visitor center flamingo is a really large osprey nest. So the osprey like to build these large stick nests on top of structures, man-made structures. And the ranger had said that NOAA had put a monitoring station, had built this tower, and the osprey built a nest on top of it. So the NOAA people came out and they destroyed the nest, and the osprey built a nest again the following year. So NOAA just gave up and gave them that tower and then put another tower up.
Okay. You're not talking about descendants of NOAA and the Ark, are you?
No. Sorry.
So tell people, NOAA. Tell the people national, who know about
the National
NOAA.
Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the National Weather Service is part of NOAA. And the National Marine Fisheries Service, who handles the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So they're a pretty big agency, but they're part of the Department of Commerce.
Yeah, so NOAA's huge, mm-hmm. huge agency. I compare them to an octopus with their arms out in all directions because mm-hmm. we also work for them in the plankton monitoring program.
Oh, that's true.
Right?
Yeah,
we also do it for NOAA. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So, when I worked in the park, which is now about 15 years ago, ospreys were on the way back, but they hadn't come back very strong yet. And why did they die out?
What happened? DDT.
The DDT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pesticide was destroying
it. Affecting the eggs, mm-hmm. the calcium production for the eggshells. So the eggs were being laid and the shells were very weak, so the eggs got destroyed easily. Mm-hmm. So I remember when I was working in Everglades City, I used to do the tour on the boat. You know, there's a boat that went through the 10,000 islands, and I would do the talk on the mangroves and the critters and all that. And there was an osprey nest that was leaning out into the water. You know, the 10,000 islands are all these 10,000 islands surrounded by brackish water, tidal currents in and out. And the water is a little brown from tannic acid, from the leaves falling in. And there was an osprey nest that was built on a pole that was sticking out into the canal that we went by every day with the boat. And I saw this thing, and it looked like it was going to fall any day.
Oh,
and
wow.
Sure enough, a week or two later, we had a windstorm, and the nest fell into the water, okay? There were no eggs in it, luckily. But the adults, they didn't know what to do of the osprey. So I told it to our law enforcement rangers, and they went out and took a look. So they told the maintenance guys that maybe they could do something. So they went out, took a boat out, right? They took a ladder, and they rebuilt this nest for the ospreys, right? And stuck it back in. And sure enough, a few days later, the parents came back.
Wow.
Well, they weren't parents yet, and they laid eggs.
Wow.
So this was an example of your tax money at work. Something good from your tax
Indeed.
Money.
Mm-hmm.
It must have cost them $15,000 to do this, to send these guys out, mm-hmm. to rebuild the nest, stick it back in the substrate, and They did a good job, but mm-hmm. that was just an interesting thing on Ospreys.
Yeah, well, now the Osprey have really recovered. There are so many. I mean, yeah. the first time you see them, you're excited, and then after a while, you're like, oh, it's another Osprey. But the exciting thing about this nest right at the visitor center is there were young in the nest, and we could,
yeah,
see,
could
them
see them
hunting.
Yeah.
And the Osprey exclusively eat fish.
Right.
So we could see them catching the fish, and they have razor-sharp talons to dive into the water and grab the fish, and then they have barbed things on their talons to hold the wiggling fish. And we went to another ranger-led program, and the ranger said that the osprey are very courteous birds, and after they catch the fish, they turn it around so it's head first to give the fish a good view and make it more aerodynamic as they fly the fish
back
to the nest.
That's why it's easier mm-hmm. to fly back with it in mm-hmm. that position. Yeah. That's true. They actually turn the fish around.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see an osprey holding a fish, it's invariably, with the head first and all that. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you one more quick osprey story. When I was camping out in the 10,000 Islands, and we were paddling out to one of the islands, we saw an osprey do this beautiful, you know, dive and come up with a fish. Beautiful. It was nice to watch. And about 30 seconds later, he was gaining altitude. An eagle came.
Bald eagle.
A bald eagle came and started to harass him. And he harassed him until he dropped the fish.
Mm-hmm.
And the eagle swooped down and grab the fish.
Wow.
You know, that's the eagle's lifestyle.
Yeah. Well, if you go to the American Museum of Natural History, there's a nice photo display on the
right.
second floor, and it shows the bald eagle fighting with a fish with another bald eagle. I think
right.
there might be an osprey in that photo display.
Probably. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those in that little gallery upstairs. Mm-hmm. Nice. I think
it's between African peoples and African mammals.
Yeah, I think Richard Ettinger, I think that's his name,
mm-hmm.
who did the photographs, or some of them anyhow. Yeah. Okay, so I think, Jack, that's it? Okay, so we're going to have to end now. So we're going to leave you in suspense, because the next chapter is going to deal with a canoe trip, a dangerous canoe trip into the wilderness, where they had to fight off hostile critters like mosquitoes. So we'll be back with another show next week. And the next week's show, we'll talk about further adventures in Everglades. And Ariana will be back with Pierre, and they'll tell you more of their adventures in the wilds of South Florida.
Whole Foods Market celebrates Earth Month with the Do Something Real Film Festival, a collection of six provocative, character-driven films focused on food, environmental issues, and everyday people with a greater vision. Come see one of the six features at City Cinemas Village East from Saturday, April 16th through Thursday, April 21st, every night at 6 p.m. Learn more about the films and special events at www.dosomethingreal.com. That's www.dosomethingreal.com. Sponsored by Whole Foods Market. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great-tasting, high-quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.